So here we are in Proverbs 8 tonight, and we hope to also get into 9. Proverbs 8 has a lot of, in some way, disconnected proverbs that are just sort of stitched together loosely, generally in terms of this whole question of relationships, how we relate to various individuals and groups and so on. So now, one thing I'd like to say, maybe as an introductory remark, is that these proverbs are really like any biblical text. They're not meant to be standalone truths that you just take them and absolutize them. Sometimes one biblical text will be clarified by another. Sometimes a biblical text will be balanced by another. You know, for example, God is all merciful. Well, we can probably find some texts in the Bible that back that up. But there's also texts that tell us, well, yes, but God, who is all merciful, also does punish wrongdoing and so on. So, in other words, we don't want one text to become the whole text. We need it to be balanced by others which don't necessarily contradict it as much as they balance it or draw it into some kind of a tension. Just like if you've ever had to give a talk, or certainly I give talks all the time, I can't say everything in the talk, although you know I try to. But sometimes you have to leave some things unsaid which need to be clarified later and so on. Well, Father, you know, you said, you know, blah, 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 blah. Well, that must mean that da-da-da-da. Well, yes and no, because if I'd had time, I would have added this and tweaked that a little bit. So, in other words, please try to understand that when we look at these proverbs, some of them can be a little controversial standing all by themselves, but in the whole of Scripture, they may be making a point that is either clarified later, balanced later, or in some way reinforced later, any number of possibilities. So keep that in mind as we go through some of these things. For example, this very first one, it says here, "Do not contend with an influential man, lest you fall into his power." Well, where would we be if Martin Luther King hadn't contended with some powerful men, right? So it's not as though this should be some absolute proverbs that never to be violated. But there's a place for this, right? There is a kind of a sobriety that we have to sometimes have, that we're not always able to engage in every battle. We don't always have the capacity to die on every hill and fight every fight. Sometimes we have to pick and choose. We have to be careful when to contend, how to contend, what tactics to use, who to go up against, and so on. Yes, this principle has its place. And yet, there are times that it should be, and in fact is violated. You know, if you find a good fight, get in it. Right, that's another proverb. It's not in the scriptures, but it's a very valid point that there are sometimes there is a time to fight for what is right, to get in there and to risk everything for what is right. So here we have basically again a kind of a sobering statement that says, "Don't contend with an influential man, lest you fall into his power." Now notice the text here says contend, so it doesn't mean never deal with influential or powerful people, but it does say it cautions us about contending against them, which is basically, again, going up against them, picking a fight, going and deciding, and so on. Well, again, this proverb has its place. Are we clear on that? But there are times to violate it. Okay. It moves on here. Let's go down to verse 12, which has a very similar thing to say. "Lend not to one more powerful than yourself. Whatever you lend, count it as lost." So again, that text probably means two things. It could mean just because you lent someone more powerful, but another biblical principle is that when you do lend money, you might get it back, but just presume you won't. You know, how many times have you had to lend money to people and they said they'd pay you back, but they never did, and they really couldn't, and you know, you just say, well, you know, if you can pay me back, great. If not, you know, just take it. So, again, it can mean that way, too. But, again, just the idea here of not allowing ourselves to unnecessarily fall into conflict with influential and powerful people. Perhaps we can get our needs met by dealing with someone who's a little bit closer to us on the food chain, if you pardon the expression. So someone that we can deal with. Caution being what it is, all right? So notice, this is a caution. It's not an absolute principle. Never contend with a powerful man. Well, then fine. Endure injustice for the rest of your life and hand on this injustice to your children and your grandchildren? Well, maybe not. There are times. So again, you see the vision. All right, now number two, back up to verse two. It says here regarding the rich, don't quarrel with a rich man lest he pay out the price of your downfall, for gold has dazzled many and perverts the character of princes. Some people think just because they're rich, they should have everything their way. And if you throw up against them, you know, they'll pay off someone, maybe not literally to kill you, but they can use their money and their influence to really make your life difficult. And again, all this is simply a call to sobriety. It's a time to go to do the fight anyway. But there are other times where we say, well, maybe I shouldn't choose to die on this hill. Maybe I'll live to fight another day. In this case, I'm going to back down right now. We're going to regroup. We're going to look at going about this a different way. Or build our forces. Go out and get some reinforcements, so to speak. You know, Jesus tells the parable of a king who Jesus says, be careful about your decisions. He says, think of a king who's going to go up against with an army of 10,000 to go up against an army of 20,000. Will he not send for peace? In other words, make sure that you're up for the battle. Make sure you have the resources you need, and be careful before you commit to go into things which may be beyond you, and in the end are simply a futile fight, and you simply either end up dead or completely marginalized. When if you'd been a little smarter, and you might have spend some time, instead of going into a rash conflict, you would have stepped back, kept your powder dry, waited for a better day, a better opportunity to deal with it. See, what happens sometimes is we just get angry, and we want to get it solved. No! And we're not able to kind of, again, keep our powder dry. And, okay. Now, moving on, it says here, be careful about rash and angry men, all right? There are some people who just don't do a good job of controlling their anger. And this text says, watch out for people like this. Okay? Dispute not with a man of railing speech. Heap no wood on his fire. Be not too familiar with an unruly man, lest he speak of ill of your forebears. Kind of a funny way of putting it. And then down to number 16, provoke no quarrel with a quick-tempered man, nor ride with him through the desert, for bloodshed is nothing to him. And there is no one to help. He will destroy you. So again, hot-tempered people, just steer clear. Yeah, just be on your guard with hot-tempered people. Again, this is not an absolute norm. There are times to confront even a hot-tempered man, saying, look, you got to cool off, man. You got to stop this. But there are other times just to say, look, all I'm going to do is throw more wood on the fire. He's just going to get angrier, and something really bad will happen. So, again, a simple call to sobriety is simply saying to us, just be careful. Be careful about contending with people who you think, well, I can change them. Well, yeah, but maybe not. We've all dealt with people who just have a bad temper. And sometimes the best thing to do is just kind of keep our distance. Just stay away. Okay? All right. do you feel any need to comment? I think most of these are, so far at least, fairly self-explanatory. Again, with this proviso in mind that, remember, these are not meant to be absolute without any qualification norms, but they're general rules of conduct, general advice, where and in general situations, where sometimes in specific situations we may do something very different for good reason. All right, then. Regarding the repentant sinner, how should you deal with them? Shame not a repentant sinner. Remember, we are all guilty. So every now and then someone comes to you and asks an apology for something they've done. Be kind about this. Have you ever tried to apologize to someone and they just let you have it with both barrels? You know, you just felt, yeah. And you're not too likely to ever apologize to them again. All you wanted to do was just kind of apologize and kind of, let's move on. Part of apologizing is that usually when there's been a conflict, there are some things that even the person who ends up apologizing is a victim of. Sometimes the other person reacted rashly. In other words, it was a contribution of both parties to the problem. And although one had a greater need to apologize, sometimes the other contributed. And still, sometimes you let them have it with both barrels. And again, the text simply says, if someone comes to you and apologizes, be gracious. Accept their apology. Now, we talked about this before, though. Just because someone apologizes for something they've done doesn't always mean you can just, pretend that everything's wonderful and it never happened and you can now live in peace with everyone. And again, the classic example would be a case where a repeat offender comes to you. Let's say they're an addict. And let's say they're an adult child and they want to come and live in your home and you're the parent. And, the bottom line is they're using. And by God, you know, they went and got high, and they said and did some bad things, and they got arrested. And they come back, and they say, yeah, I'm really sorry. I'm really going to try better. It's never going to happen again. Will you let me stay here again? And sometimes you have to say, I accept your apology, but no, you can't stay here. See? So in other words, accepting an apology doesn't just mean, okay, here I am, I'm a carpet walk all over me, either. But on the other hand, try to be gracious, accept the apology, be kind to people who apologize, who come to you, who are repentant for what they have said or done. And yet that doesn't always mean that you can completely live in peace with them. Yes, Jeanette?
I've already been through that.
Yeah. I just want to be all happy.
For the nephew, one of my brother's sons, tied up with those guys out there with the drugs and all that mess.
Yeah.
I had been to a gospel program one Sunday night, and my brother stayed with me, and I came in. There, his son was living with his niece.
Mm-hmm.
And she don't really mind. So why am I taking him in?
Mm-hmm. What do they know that you don't know?
So when I came in, it's about 11 o'clock, I'm coming from a church program.
Hmm.
And I'm all happy and joyful. See, the devil won't try to pull my joy down anyway, you know. So when I get to the house, my brother said, hey, Jeanette, Ronnie want to know if he can bring his clothes over here. Now, this is in February now, so it's cold.
Yeah.
Most of the time of year, February. I was in the bathroom, so I didn't even answer. Now I said, well, what is going to bring his clothes over here? I thought he was staying on Christine's. Come to find out Christine, I'm putting out.
Yeah. So again, what does she know that we don't know?
Right. So when Brent bring his clothes over my house, I said, now if he bring his clothes over there, they're all ready to put those meters out in front of all the houses in D.C. You know he's going to be running back and forth taking baths and showers and stuff. Then with the kind of friends we got, we don't need them running over there with them drugs and stuff.
Yeah.
And so I didn't answer. I was so disgusted. I said, now Satan trying to kill my joy because I had a ball in the gospel program where I went.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I went in the room, I didn't say a word, I changed my clothes. See, my brother dropped it on me. He didn't want to tell his own son he couldn't come.
Yeah.
But I came with Janessa in charge. Go in the room, change my clothes, go back out the door. Because he said he had been robbed, my brother said he had been called. So I didn't even listen to the answer, so I went back out the house. Instead of the car, I'm going to go over to my daughter's. So I wouldn't be there again. So I go back out the car, and I sit in the car like this, and I start saying the Lord's Prayer. And some kind of way, I fall off to sleep, standing in front of the door, because I knew if I move the car, I'm going to get another car, they might come back. I sit up there and go to sleep. When I woke up, I look around, going on one third, corner two.
Outside your own house.
I didn't hear no more about it. The whole week went by, I didn't hear no more. So it was cold. So he found somewhere to drop his clothes.
Yeah.
And I didn't say no more about it. And I know my brother just dropped it on me. Because he didn't want to tell his own son no. But he didn't want him in the air. I know he didn't want to put him in the air.
Yes. Okay. Well, anyway, you know, the basic point is, I think, again, pretty much in front of us. We try to be kind when people ask, seek apologies, and where possible, just make amends and move on. But there may be occasions where we have to, you know, remember and hold boundaries and be careful with people who are guilty, especially of repeat offenders. And we can be kind and gracious and accept that. But in the end, we have to sometimes be on our guard. All right. Then it goes on to say here, number six, don't insult him, or insult no man when he is old, for some of us, too, will grow old. It's kind of a little poignant thing. Some of us will grow old. You know, it's our expectation in our culture that all of us will grow old. But this text, you know, was in a time when people would tend to die often more early than today of diseases and things. And so a certain number of people made it to old age, but not as many as today. So it's kind of a poignant thing there. But the other thing is that, you know, obviously with old age comes things that we have to put up with, especially in those days that they become hard of hearing. What's that? Could you repeat that? And slow of gait. You know, you get behind an elderly person sometimes, and, you know, it gets a little annoying, you know. Come on, move it up, you know. Or they're driving slowly, or they tell the same stories over and over, their memories, you know. So we have a lot sometimes to tolerate, and it tends to create a kind of a climate where we either curse or insult or speak of them behind their back and so on. And simply, again, a call to humility that, you know, you too may be old and feeble one day and you'll need people to put up with you and be patient with you and repeat things and put up with you repeating things. And all of these are clearly... Well, how many times we learn this lesson in life? You know, many times. You know, when we're a kid, we think, I'll never do that when I'm a parent. And then we do exactly that when we're a parent. We say the exact same things our parents said. So we begin to learn that we tend to laugh at or scorn people who are older than us. But when we get to that place, we say, oh, now I see. You know, so anyway, I remember sometimes laughing at old men who wore suspenders. And, but I understand now. When you have a little bit of a belly and you sit down with a belt, it kind of hurts, frankly. It's just that's uncomfortable, and it's better to have suspenders. All right. All right. So, at any rate, good. But as I say, as I get older, too, I really begin to understand, you know, some of the things that elderly people I've noticed in the past, you know, and you know, you need to grope for their glasses. Can they can read something. Well, I mean, I really can't even see most of your faces right now. I mean, that's how blurry it is when I take my glasses off. And 10 years ago, I didn't need to wear them at all. So, we slide quickly. All right, now, regarding the deceased, we've seen a proverb about the deceased before. It simply says, rejoice not when a man dies. Remember, we are all to die. Now, it may well be that the death of a person does take a lot of heat off of you. It could well be that there is some sense of relief sometimes when a person dies who was of great trouble to us. But we should not, as this text says, rejoice over that. We should simply remember this is a very sober reminder that all of us are going to die. The best thing to do when someone dies is to recall your own mortality. Pray for yourself that you'll be ready for death. Pray for a death for which you are prepared. A death that does not come suddenly and catch you unprepared. Every now and then someone says, well, what a blessing to go in your sleep. I'm not so sure I really want to go in my sleep. I'd like a little time to prepare. Now, God will decide what that will be for me. But in the end, I think that, again, all of us should have a great deal of sobriety when we encounter the death of people regarding our own mortality. That's what this text is saying. Notice again how often this text is saying, don't laugh at someone in this or that situation. Don't do this because you may well be there one day. Or, you know, you are in this condition already. So, again, these are reminders to us to remember that as much as we like to point our finger at other people, three fingers are always pointing back at you when you point. Your own, that's Father, Son, and Holy Spirit right there. See them? And they're reminding you that you too, oh man, will, if you have not already done this, you will experience it. Now, it moves on to say here, regarding the deceased, that, you know, again, that we should rejoice not when a man dies, and to remember that we are all to die. All right? So, again, pray for the dead, especially someone who troubled you, who has led a life that, you know, led you to worry about maybe their salvation. Maybe they especially need your prayers when they die. Maybe they are going to spend extra time in purgatory, if they're lucky enough to get there. There are people who have greatly troubled us. But again, maybe this is a call to pray a lot. All right, then, regarding the wise, it simply says here, spurn not the discourse of the wise, but acquaint yourself with their proverbs, for from them you will acquire training to serve in the presence of princes. So, again, we talked about this, I think, last week and probably the week before. One of the problems today is that the proverbs of the wise are often spurned by the younger generation. Now, this has, I suppose, always been a problem in the human condition, but we live in a time where I think this is especially problematic, where there's a lot more of this than there has been in previous generations, where this kind of the young really do spurn the wisdom of the elders and the wise. There's been a kind of a wholesale overthrowing of tradition, a wholesale of casting out of traditional things. Now, little by little, I see that we're beginning to pick up and acquire some of the traditions of old again and to learn from the wisdom of generations gone by. I am particularly impressed in this regard with many of the younger priests who are being ordained now, who have a much deeper sense of the beauty of the tradition of the church, the beauty of the wisdom of the fathers of the church, of the scriptures. There's a real sense of going back and picking up. You know, sometimes a family heirloom goes up into the attic. One generation says, oh, this old piece of junk, you know, they threw it up in the attic. And then it takes maybe the grandchild to go up there and say, wow, a Tiffany lampshade. This is beautiful. Oh, that old piece of junk. Sure, yeah. I mean, at some point in the 70s, I think we were, you know, we were kind of into sort of minimalist kinds of things, and we cast a lot of things into the attic, so to speak. And sometimes the younger generation goes back up into the attic and they say, "Ooh, neat." And they could take it down and polish it up. And I think I see some of that beginning to happen. I know in some of the younger priests who are ordained now, who have a great love for tradition and a great openness to the wisdom of ages gone by. Whereas I think we went through the 60s and the 70s, there was kind of a radical, what do they know? They're just a bunch of old people. They're all dead. Bunch of dead white men. What do they have to tell me about living today? You know, and so that was kind of the attitude. And now I think, I don't know if this is common throughout our culture, but I am beginning to notice that younger people in general are more willing to go back a couple generations and pick up some of the wisdom that's been left behind. So, now, again, notice it tells you why you should not reject this tradition. Says here, the wise. Spurn not the discourse of the wise, but acquaint yourself with their proverbs. Again, for from them, these proverbs, and also these older people, you will acquire training to serve in the presence of princes. I mean, why should every generation have to relearn from scratch what other generations learned, right? We should be able to kind of grow in a kind of a collective knowledge. Obviously, you know, the old expression, reinventing the wheel. A lot of times, although we're pretty good at keeping our technology moving forward into the future, we're not so good about keeping our values and our religious sensibilities. We tend to keep wanting to reinvent the wheel in that department, and that's where I think we run into trouble. Now, it goes on to say something very similar here then regarding traditions, as I've already remarked. Reject not the tradition of old men, which they have learned from their fathers, since from it you will obtain knowledge of how to answer in time of need. Okay, so why keep relearning everything? You know, glean the wisdom of ages gone by. Now, does this mean that ages gone by are impeccable and perfect and they had all things well? And, you know, there's another proverb which I think we'll encounter later on in the book of Sirach. It says, do not say, how is it that former times were better than these? Because it is not in wisdom that you speak this. So we're not saying that previous times were perfect or without any problem. Again, I stand here in a room full of numerous African Americans. For me to say, oh, weren't the 50s a wonderful time, that might not have been your experience. See, there might have been some very different experiences of, you know, during Jim Crow and some of this sort of stuff that went on. We're not trying to say that all previous ages were wonderful and perfect, but there is a wisdom that has stood the test of time that we should, again, embrace and learn and listen to very, very carefully. And that's the idea here. And again, we live in... Do you know what I mean by the term iconoclastic? this is one of those $10 words that... But it describes the kind of culture we've been going through for a long time. Iconoclasm literally means in Latin... I mean, it's actually Greek roots... Icono means an image, and clastic means to smash images. So you take a beautiful old statue in a church and you say, this is an old piece of junk, and you just smash it to bits and throw it away and replace it with nothing. This is called iconoclasm. Well, you can do that to statues, or like somebody painted over the wall in the 70s in the back of our church, and we just finally got it back. You can talk about buildings and things, but iconoclasm is a broader thing. It means you just take the wisdom and the beauty of things gone by and you smash them and replace them with nothing. See? We have been living, I think we're beginning to see a little bit of a change in this, but we live in iconoclastic times, where we just smash the things of the past, the family heirlooms, whether it be physical family heirlooms, all that old piece of junk and throw it in the attic or throw it in the trash, or whether it be the more spiritual and cultural family heirlooms, we just throw them away. We have no regard for them, and we put nothing really in their place. We just live in the here and the now, and we reject the wisdom of the past. So one has often described this culture of ours as not only iconoclastic, but nihilistic. Again, more $10 words. Nihil in Latin means nothing. And So we basically just take the things that are and reduce them to nothing. Many of you, again, I don't mean to merely dwell on church architecture, but it's kind of symbolic. Many of you remember times when most of our churches were really, really quite beautifully decorated with statues and paintings, you know, much like our churches. We're very blessed to have received and largely maintained a church that's intact. But some people went through some of these older churches. Any of you been down to St. Patrick's down on 10th Street? And you might see somebody went in there about 10 years ago and just gutted the place, tore all the statues out and just threw them all in the trash. And you basically got whitewashed walls. And I'm not saying it's unattractive today, but it's just basically empty compared to what used to be there. Beautiful statues and side altars and candles and paintings and frescoes on the wall. All of that's been gone, whitewashed. Very, very common in Catholic churches throughout the country and even throughout the world that they took beautiful, beautiful old churches and they just tore them, tore down the altars, they tore down statues and really replaced them with nothing, just empty.
Do you have a reason why they did that?
Well, I have an idea, having talked to some of the men of that generation, you know, some of the priests who actually did those things, I can tell you what they told me. They really felt that the Catholicism of the future needed to appeal to a rationalistic scientific culture, which saw all things in very material and concrete and materialistic ways, and all this clutter in our churches was kind of old women piety. It was the piety of old women who would light the candles and you know, say their novenas, and they thought of it as something superstitious. So the whole thing sort of seemed to them to be implausible to a modern world that was going in a very different, rationalistic direction.
When they tore down
the altar rail.
The altar rail.
Yeah.
Some people had a fit. Some people left the church and didn't come back.
Mm.
Yeah, right.
And then there was something happened up in the choir, though. The lady that was playing the altar, she didn't come back.
Yeah, right.
Oh, when they tore St. Cyprian's down.
That's right.
When they tore St. Cyprian's down, a lot of people had a sickness coming around here.
Mm-hmm.
When we merged. But they had it because St. Cyprian was torn down. Now, if that was now, people would be protesting.
Right.
People just did what the Pope
wanted to do. Right. Well, anyway, but the idea, the men of that time really felt they were doing the church a service.
Right.
They weren't intentionally trying to, let's just do something evil and nasty. They thought they were doing the right thing. But again, many people, like you say, were hurt, offended. We most of us now, looking back on that time, say that was a period of great loss. Great
loss.
And again, we've recovered our walls, and I can't guarantee we can put an altar rail back, but we may get, maybe I can at least get some little bit of kneelers there before the side altars where people can kneel again. But we'll talk about that in the future. But the point is that we have a, this is kind of the elements of our culture today, which overthrow tradition. Now, does that mean, though, that we're stuck in the past and we can't ever move forward or ever update or in any way? And again, no, but I think that the idea is that growth should be kind of incremental and organic. So the idea of I think, healthy growth is that it's incremental and it's sort of organic. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, how do you and I physically change over the years? Suddenly, in an instant, little by little, we gain a pound here, a pound there, we lose a pound, we lose a little hair. I don't notice from day to day that I got this bald spot, but here I have it. But those of you who are with me day in and day out might not notice I've either gained weight or lost weight or that my hair. But someone who hasn't seen me for a year or two might say, well, you really lost a lot of hair. You put on a lot of weight, you've taken off. They'll make these comments. But for the most part, our growth as human beings is incremental. It's little by little, almost imperceptible. It builds on what's already there sheds what's already there. But there's a kind of a, you can sort of see a connection in the growth. If you were to see a picture of me when I was 15, you'd see a lot of resemblances to the way I look now, but you'd also see differences. But you could say, well, but there's a connection. That the same guy there at 15 is the same guy. He's got hair down on his shoulders and no beard but a mustache. Okay, fine. That's what I was at 15. But you'll basically see there's a connection even though there's differences. And so this, I think, is kind of the best the better way for us to grow and update and so on. So little by little, we can see changes in the church or in our houses or in our own physical appearance and so on. So these things make some sense. So I'm not trying to say you stay stuck in the past and nothing can ever change, but we build on what has gone before rather than tear it down, replace it with nothing, or simply smash what has gone before. Okay? All right. So, now, with that in mind, moving on to verse 10 there in your text, regarding the unrepentant sinner. Kindle not the coals of a sinner, lest you be consumed in this flaming fire. Let not the impious man intimidate you, it will set him in ambush against you. Now, a little complicated, but maybe not. Don't kindle the flames of a sinful person. In other words, don't put them in further temptation. If you're dealing with an angry man who's easily provoked to rash anger, inciting his anger is a bad idea. Now again, you may sometimes not be able to avoid that. There may be just times where you have to say, well, I'm sorry, we're not going to do it the way you want to do it, we're going to have to do it this way, and that may incite his anger, but you don't intentionally want to incite anger. Or, I think I told you the story when I was in working in the Corps of Engineers, my boss came to me one day and said, Chucky, he called me Chucky, he said, take your wallet and I'll put it in your pocket. And I said, well, all right, but I said, Mr. Crabb, I'll do that, but why? He said, well, I don't want you to ever leave that wallet out on that table. I said, well, I said, I'm not worried that anyone's going to take it. He said, well, I am. And he said, don't ever attempt anything. You don't know what people are tempted to, so don't put temptation in people's way. So obviously, to not kindle the sins of other people. This, of course, then goes to other questions like how we behave in the presence of others, and not to be gossipy and incite other people who may be weak in that regard into gossip, or to dress modestly so that we don't incite sexual excitement in people who struggle with that area of their life. To act and behave in a way that's edifying and becoming, rather than drawing people down into silliness and stupidity. And so on. So the idea is to be among people in a way that does not incite, there it says here, how does it put it? Kindle not the coals of a sinner. So we don't want to stir up sin in other people. So one of the ways we show love to each other is to not become a temptation or a stumbling block to one another. Okay? And then it says, lest you be consumed in his flaming fire. And then, you know, I was talking to someone the other day about this horrible problem we're having in our culture about pedophilia. Now, first of all, a few definitions I think are in order when we look at this terrible problem. True pedophilia is sexual attraction to true children. That is to say, children who are not in any way sexually mature. Okay? Unfortunately, most of what you're seeing among some of the sexual sins of priests, and also you hear of other people who commit sexual abuse, it isn't really little children they're going after, but the teenagers, the young teenagers, who are sexually mature in the physical sense, but are not emotionally and intellectually mature. So it isn't exactly right to call this pedophilia, but there isn't really another name for it. Someone has proposed the term ephebophilia, which refers to a teenager. You know, that in Greek, ephiba means someone who's, you know, a teenager. I think we get the word plebe and stuff from this word. But anyway, whatever we want to call it, it's a horrible problem. But on the other hand, it's frustrating to me because our culture so sexualizes children. To begin, when I say children, I mean like young teenagers. You know, the Britney Spears, she's older now, but I mean when she was a young popular performer, she was dressed very scantily, and she was just a young teenage girl, and she's flaunting her sexuality, and everyone was applauding this. And I don't know who the latest Hannah Montana's or whoever the latest incarnation of this sexualized children, or some of these beauty contests. It's terrifying the way some of these little girls are all dolled up in a way that they're actually meant to be sexually appealing. And here they are all of 12 or 13 years of age, and it's sickening. Let them have their innocence and let them grow up, but we tend to sexualize them in the movie, the music that we listen to, and so on. And then we're shocked and horrified that somebody actually acts on this. How can they do that? And yet, it's all throughout our culture that there is a sexualization of young teenage girls, especially. It's remarkable to me the duplicity of our culture in this regard. Now, please don't misunderstand that I'm trying to in any way excuse this behavior, but I'm just saying that I think a lot of times our culture is aghast at certain things that we are actually very, you know, part of it inciting. Now, for example, the glamorizing of smoking, which was so common in the movies, and we're shocked that young people want to smoke. Well, look at the way we've glamorized it in the movies, you know. Now, I think that's beginning to end. I don't see much of that in the movies anymore. Same with drinking and other behaviors. We glamorize these things, and then we're shocked and horrified that somebody actually takes us up on the idea and actually starts to live that way. And again, the text simply says here, look, do not kindle the coals of a sinner. And we're all sinners. I don't want you, but I don't want someone to just come along and tempt me. I think I'm pretty strong, but I may not be that strong. So don't do it. See? And so, likewise, you know, I shouldn't act in ways that tempt others. And further, we need to look at this at a larger cultural value. Now, of course, I'm not saying that all of us in this room are involved in sexualizing children. But I'm just saying our culture in general does that kind of stuff. And it's sickening and it's awful. And we see a lot of teenage sexual activity portrayed in our modern entertainment industry. And it's completely unthinkable that we do that. And yet, and then we're shocked when somebody actually gets on the internet and does crazy stuff and tries to actually call up these young teenagers because they've been so conditioned to think of them in sexual ways. And again, it all needs to stop, is my point. Not that we're trying to excuse this behavior, which is terrible and sinful, but it is something which, unfortunately, does have a context in which it exists.
But they're ending up with a problem now. I think it's in your future because when you send the explicit photos across the internet, and they arrest the people to do it. They are then labeled as a sexual predator.
Yes.
Whether having these 13 and 12-year-olds sending the pictures now.
I think they call it sexting.
Yeah.
Instead of sending a text message, you send a naked picture of yourself to your boyfriend or girlfriend. And, you're right. And technically, these kids can actually be arrested for sending child pornography across. And it's a little absurd to arrest a kid for sending a picture of their girlfriend to some other 13 or 15-year-old kid. But, you know, kids do dopey stuff. But the point is they take us up on this offer when we start to sexualize them. And so you're right, this is going down now to the lowest levels. The children are beginning to act out in many terrible ways. And but where do they get all this? Well, they get it from us. I say us, not all of us in the room, but from adults in our culture who do this kind of stuff. And so, anyway, serious issues. And again, I tried to give you some other examples as well. So, regarding then the sinner, don't kindle the coals of a sinner, lest you be consumed in his flaming fire. And so we're beginning to see now this horrific problem of sexual abuse of minors and so on. And so we're finding that in enkindling the coals of libido, we tend to find that many of our own family members and others get consumed with this kind of stuff, and in fact, perhaps some of us. And so we have to be careful. Don't do that. If you put sin out there, I promise you, it will begin to influence you back. Okay. And then it says here, don't let the impious man intimidate you. It will set him in ambush against you. Now, it's not exactly clear to me what the second half of this means, but there are going to be people that when you and I object to this sexualization, for example, of young people, say, oh, you're a bunch of prudes, there you go again. And the church is always about sex, isn't it? Oh, you're all hung up about sex. They're going to try to intimidate, you see. And it's not that we're hung up about sex. You want to know who's hung up about sex? Turn on the TV. Okay, that's who's hung up about sex. The fact that we object or in any way, they try to intimidate us, call us names, get us to back down, call us, you know, conservative, they call us reactionary, they call us intolerant, they'll call us homophobes, whatever they want to call us. But don't let the impious man intimidate you, okay, is this. So, in other words, when we see sin, it's important to see it for what it is, and where necessary, you know, with all these other cautions in mind, to speak out about it and say, this is wrong, it's wrong. Now, the second half of it, though, seems to sort of take that away a little bit. It says, it will set him in ambush against you. But I think what it's getting at is when they perceive weakness in us, they go even further. You know, the world will never be satisfied with us just saying, well, it's okay if a person does what they want in their private bedroom. See, isn't that what a lot of Christians have been cowed into saying? Oh, it's none of my business what somebody does in their bedroom. We feel so good as we say it. And they say, but now they don't want to just do it in their bedroom. They want to do it on the TV. They want to do it in public. They want to, well, you see what I'm saying? So in other words, to the degree that we've allowed people to intimidate us and say, well, nothing matters if it's private between two consenting adults and so on, and that we should have no opinions about any of these things, even though the scriptures tell us to have opinions, nevertheless, we find that we let them intimidate us. We say, well, it's okay if you just do it in private, blah, 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 and we start to compromise with them, and what do? They go further and further, and they demand more and more and more. And so this is basically a call to stand your ground, to never put sin out there and stoke the coals of fire in somebody else, but also to speak out where necessary and not be intimidated when people answer you back. You know, one of the things is when you do an action, you should expect a reaction, right? And that's all right. People are going to react. But again, be strong, be willing to do it, and don't be intimidated. Do not. But most Christians are intimidated. We just can't bear to be called intolerant. Well, tolerance is about showing mercy to sinners. Tolerance is about, tolerance is not about backing down on what are our values. Okay, so it's not appropriate what they're asking for. Okay, that we should just tolerate everything. Now, of course, when you say, "Hey, I think I've told you, try this experiment; it works every time." When somebody says, I think we should be more tolerant, you say, I don't think so. I think there should be limits to tolerance. Watch how quickly intolerant they become of you. Mm-hmm. See what I'm saying? They break their own rule in a minute. When you say to them, I don't know, I'm not sure about that. I don't think there should be unlimited tolerance. I think there's limits to tolerance. Voila! Suddenly, they're intolerant. Mm-hmm. They're breaking the very rule that they're claiming to salute. So their own tolerance doesn't extend to everybody. It certainly doesn't extend to Bible-believing Christians, I can tell you that. I know it doesn't extend there. All right. Now, moving on, regarding loans. Again, you can see that this is kind of a wide-ranging kind of collection of things here. All right. Lend not to one more powerful than yourself. We've already looked at that. You might not get it back. All right. Go not to surety beyond your means. Think any pledge a debt you must pay. So in other words, don't back up somebody's loan if you're not able to pay it. Presume that if you're going to co-sign on a loan or you're going to just presume it's your debt. Okay. So in other words, just be sober about this. People will sometimes ask for things, and they're really sure they can pay you back, but in the end, they really can't, and it's yours. It's yours. So basically, it just says sobriety, sobriety, sobriety. Okay. All right. Regarding judges, verse 14, contend not at law with a judge, for he will settle it according to his whim. All right. Unfortunately, even in our system, which we think so highly of, basically the judge will make his decision or her decision. And you're a little bit at the mercy of this situation. Now, granted, there are appeals and things, but most appeals don't go very far. So the point is, you know, again, not to contend not at law with a judge. In other words, I don't think it ever means that you shouldn't try to persuade the judge to come to your point of view, but it's saying don't contend the point of law with the judge. All right? As though somehow you know better than the judge. Now I wouldn't necessarily think this would apply to lawyers, whose job it is to kind of instruct the judge a little bit, to say, Judge, I want to remind you of the following precedents and the following laws, and the judge says, thank you, I knew that, of course. What was that again? But anyway, the point is that that's the part of the job of a lawyer. But I think what it's saying is for you and me not to kind of get up there and lecture a judge, but when you're before a judge, be humble, make your case, and trust that the judge will judge justly. Okay? So when it says here, don't argue about law, basically, and it says here, contend. But don't argue the point of law with a judge. He probably knows the law better than you do anyway. Okay? All right. Now, the unmerciful. Verse 15. Travel not with a ruthless man, lest he weigh you down with calamity. Okay, for he will go his own straight way through his folly. You will perish with him. All right. So don't travel with a ruthless man. What does it mean? What does ruthless mean? Define ruthless.
Without ruth.
Okay. There you go. Less than the amount of ruth that he should have, at least. Right. Well, again, ruthless just means no mercy. What's that?
No values.
No values. Generally speaking, no mercy. No. Just hang them high. Hang them high. Yeah, not good morals, but generally to a person who is ruthless is a person who just has no problem whatsoever of just lowering the boom and being as harsh and as mean and as ugly with people as they can, because by God, they don't matter and I do. Now, to some extent, ruthless people have no morals and so on, but generally speaking, to be ruthless means you have no mercy for anybody else. It's what you want and your way or the highway. And so basically, don't hang with people like that, because they might weigh you down with calamity. Because people like that tend to acquire enemies pretty quickly. And he'll go his own straight way. He'll go his own way straight, and through his folly you will perish with him. Okay? So don't hang out with ruthless people. Remember Jesus, remember the story of the men who brought this woman before Jesus who had committed adultery. And it's a curious scene, a lot of theories about it, but they basically say, we think that we should be able to throw the book at this woman. The law permits us to stone this woman. Now, the law actually said that both the man and the woman should be stoned. Let's be clear about that, first of all. Now, obviously, the man is known because it says that she was caught in the very act of committing adultery. Okay, so you can see they're duplicitous to begin with. They brought only the woman up on charges. All right. Now, second, that's the first problem that they have with the law. But the second problem is they want to throw the book at her. Now, as you know, even in those days, there may have been a penalty assigned to a certain infraction of the law. Namely, you could stone somebody to death who commits adultery. All right, fine. That's permitted by the law. But that does not mean that every time that the law is broken, that that is the law that absolutely was used, or the punishment that absolutely was used. It tended, just like we do today, you might have, for a certain crime, 20 years. But given the circumstances, and so on, the judge may assign 15 years or 8 years or something less. In those times, it was often the case too. But basically, they come to Jesus and they say, we want you to throw the book at this woman. We think that she should be stoned. How say you, Rabbi? And they were trying to trap Jesus. Now, then he does something a little odd. He gets down and starts tracing on the ground. Now, somebody said, well, he was writing their sins. Well, problem is, most people didn't read. And there probably wasn't a lot of dirt to write in because they were on a stone pavement. So the fact that he was actually writing out their sins in this dirt is kind of figuratively interesting, but unlikely in reality. What exactly he was doing, we're not sure. He might have been indicating some writing of the angel who writes, the recording angel who writes all of our deeds in the book. Maybe he was just reminding them of this. So who knows? Exactly. Well, there's a lot of different theories. But all I know is that, in effect, what Jesus seems to be saying to these men is, you want me to throw the book at you? I wonder what would be in the book about all of you. Let's see now. Now, guys, before we throw the book at her, some of you have committed some sins, too. Some of you, according to this book, let me just look at some of the writing here. Some of you have blasphemed the name of God. You can be stoned to death for that. Some of you have despised the poor. This is one of the sins that cries to heaven for vengeance. Now, if you want me to throw the book at her, careful. Because that means that my Father needs to throw the book at you, too. Now, if you want absolute justice for this woman, you know, hang her high with no mercy. The measure that you measure to others will be measured back to you. Are you ready for that, guys? And one by one, beginning with the oldest, they put down their stones and they left. Because the oldest had most against them. All right, so you see, the idea is when you hang with a ruthless person, you end up becoming that way yourself, and you set yourself up poorly for the day of judgment. See? We're all going to face judgment one day. You actually have influence on the standards that God will use in judging you. Jesus will be your judge, and you actually have some influence on the standards that he will use. The measure that you measure to others will be measured back to you. If you've been merciful, you will be shown mercy. Again, the scripture says, blessed are the merciful. They will be shown mercy. The same scriptures, the book of James says, merciless is the judgment on the one who has shown no mercy. See, so, you actually have a lot of influence on how you'll be judged one day. So, again, not that we're walking around being pansies and just forgiving everything and never exacting any punishment, but there's a time for that, but there's also a time to show mercy and to not always claim that we should be able to exact the worst and the most powerful of punishments. Okay? So, that's kind of the idea of a parable like this. Okay. Moving on, regarding the fool. Now, remember, we talked about this concept of the fool. Who is the fool, you see? Well, the wise person is the one who fears the Lord, who knows that God is watching, who behaves in such a way, who seeks wisdom, who seeks to... So this is the wise person, the one who fears the Lord. So who is the fool? The one who lives as though God was not watching. The one who does not seek wisdom. The one who exists apart, who is iconoclastic and nihilistic, who simply discards the past and thinks they can completely reinvent human nature. This is the fool, all right, in wisdom literature. So the fool is the one who rejects wisdom. Now, what does it say then about the fool here? Verse 17. Take no counsel with a fool, for he can keep nothing to himself. Okay? I suppose there's other problems with fools too, but among the things that a fool, well, he can keep nothing to himself. Okay, but just take note of the first. Don't take counsel with a fool. Okay, if you know a person who does not acknowledge God, who thinks that we've come of age and that somehow we're better than previous generations and they have nothing to teach us, I wouldn't take counsel with a person like that. Go to a person who respects the tradition, who's deeply imbued in it, who loves God, who knows that God is watching, who fears the Lord. This is someone to seek counsel from. But do not seek counsel from a worldly, secular type. They can't help you. Okay. All right. And they might be able to help you and make a killing in the stock market. I don't mean and help you in nothing, but I mean, but don't seek counsel about serious things with a fool, who's disconnected from God. Then regarding the stranger, before a stranger, do nothing that should be kept secret, for you don't know what it will engender. All right. Again, we have to be discreet when we come up with, especially with people we don't know that well. We don't know, are they a blabbermouth? Will they keep quiet about what I've said or done? Will I, you know, if I share something secret, it's so easy for us to easily run our mouth, but we don't always know what people will share and how they will share it. So again, the text simply says, be very discreet. Elsewhere, these texts have said, let your acquaintances be many, but your close friends very few. Okay, so that's... All right, and then again, discretion in verse 19. Open your heart to no man, and banish not your happiness. All right, now, when it says no man, I mean, it doesn't... Again, you have to take these things into consideration. We were just told a couple of verses ago, seek counsel from the wise. So it doesn't mean just keep to yourself and don't say anything to anybody, just nod a lot and just, you know, keep a poker face and never interact. I mean, but the idea here is be careful who you open your heart to and who you reveal your secrets to, and let your very close friends who know basically everything about you, let them be very few. People that you can trust, people who you've known to be trustworthy. Be careful to share things only with them. We all need people like that in our life. We need also then to keep that number small and be very discreet with other people about what we share and don't share. Okay? Good.
I was going to say, also in Solomon tells us about happy are those... who do not follow the counsel of the wicked.
Yeah. Or delight in their ways.
Interesting, right?
Yes. Psalm, was that Psalm 2?
Yeah, the first Psalm.
Psalm 1.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, the two ways, the Psalm of the two ways. Go with the fools or with the wise. Yeah. All right. So, that's chapter 8. And as I said, there are a lot of just sort of loosely connected Proverbs, largely revolving around the questions of our relationships with one another. And we're going to kind of continue in that vein. Now, fasten your seatbelts. We've got almost an equal number of men as women tonight, so that's a blessing, men, because we may need some protection. Some things that are about to be said here. Now, let me give you some background to this text before we actually read it. Remember, this is an older man speaking to a younger man, so he's going to call the younger man to some sobriety about women. Now, this may sound a little unflattering to some of the women in the room here. It may appear to us to be, you know, stereotypical or harsh or what have you. But it is what it is. I'm not going to take the edge off of it. I'm just going to say that it is what it is. It's an older man advising a younger man. Now, I tried to share with you before that we men often need kind of advice to be a little sober about women. Because we men love eye candy.
We get intoxicated?
Yeah, easily intoxicated, yes. We lack sobriety, yes. Beauty bewitches us. It makes us sometimes do silly or inappropriate things. We don't always understand that a person's character is a greater matter than something that's skin deep. We sometimes are bewildered or befuddled by beauty, and we don't go much further, and we make dumb choices. So in questioning the upstanding quality of some women is not to say that all women are this way, but it's simply saying an older man saying to a younger man, your hormones are going to lie to you. Your passions will often blind you to deeper realities. So don't simply look to the physical attractiveness or beauty of a woman. See something deeper. And some very beautiful women are very beautiful people, but some very beautiful women are also corrupt and bad people. Likewise, women who aren't necessarily immediate eye candy, but they're good, solid women, and would be a wonderful mother and a wife. You know, again, so you gotta go beyond just the eye candy stuff. That's the point. So if you try to see some of this advice with that background, this isn't a complete all women are this way, you know, but it is a call to sobriety that men need to hear, which is that just because a woman is this or that, just remember, some women are problematic, and we just have to be honest about it. Now, therefore, it says here, starting out with regards to women, and I'm not exactly sure, would somebody have their Bible open to Sirach 9? Let's all open our Bibles. I want to see if, I meant to look up the footnote if there was one on this particular verse. It says here, be not jealous of the wife of your bosom, lest you teach her to do evil against you. I wonder if there isn't a better way of translating that word jealous. I meant to look it up, I'm sorry. Yeah, there is an asterisk. There is a prudence and reserve in dealing with women. Preserve liberty and the dignity of this person, the integrity of his possessions. A man must avoid jealousy toward his own wife and familiarity toward all other women. Okay. Well, they just treated it as simple, plain old jealousy. Okay. Well, all right. Then maybe another way of putting it that might help us to understand this text, putting it in a more positive way. Generally speaking, trust your wife. Don't presume that she's running off with all these other men. Don't do that to her. All right, develop some trust. Now, there's going to be other passages that sort of again balance this a little bit. But again, generally speaking, trust your wife, lest she grow angry with you and bitter and do evil against you. Okay, you know, if you don't feel like you're being trusted, if you feel like you're always under spied upon and being looked into, this of course becomes oppressive and it tends to incite anger and resentment and so on. So again, generally speaking, it says here, first of all, you know, not to be jealous, or let's say, maybe to put it more positively, to trust the wife of your bosom, okay? Lest you teach her to do evil against you, okay? I don't have much more to say because, like I say, I find the text. I don't want to continue to dig a hole here if I'm not exactly sure how to interpret this, so let's just move on, all right? Now, give no woman power over you to trample your dignity. Now, this gets, you know, some of the women, you know, perhaps upset. But again, give no woman power over you to trample your dignity is, again, another way of saying to a man, look, if you are too bedazzled by sexual charms and physical beauty and so on, she can, pardon the expression, but wrap you around her finger and in a way trample your dignity. You begin to lose your freedom. You start doing stupid things. She can coax you to do things that are unwise. She can in a way destroy your freedom and in a way treat you in a way that is tramples your dignity. You begin to lose your dignity. You're no longer making good, wise, or smart decisions. You're doing dumb stuff. Your wealth becomes dissipated. Why would this be? Well, again, just look at the situation today. Men go from woman to woman. They have babies by them. And there's all kinds of problems with that, too, at another level. But they're paying alimony here. They're paying money over there. They're trying to raise their own family. They finally got their act together at age 35. They finally got married and had their own wife and kids, but they've got two other kids out there that they're paying child support for. And again, all of it came to the fact that, baby, you got the curves, I've got the angles. and goes for her. And maybe she had her own struggles with chastity, whatever it was, but he let her, if you will, draw, and it's not all her fault, but again, remember, this is an older man talking to a younger man. He's just saying, now look, you know, women have their charms, and they have their own desires. Sometimes these things aren't a good mix. You be careful about this kind of stuff. She may give you the come hither look, but that doesn't mean you ought to go there. Okay. So, careful here. That's the advice. So, again, don't give a woman power over you. That is to say, by, and maybe to put it in a more virtuous way, regarding the virtues, control yourself sexually, men. Because if you don't, you will be enslaved by your, first of all, your own sexuality, and secondly, by people who have unnecessary and power over you. Okay? So, control yourself. And we see a lot of this today, where there's all kinds of people making big mistakes, because we live in a culture today that doesn't, generally speaking, encourage or even speak about sexual self-control anymore. And a lot of people, men and women, make really dumb mistakes. Now, if an older woman were writing to a younger woman, she might say, look, just because he comes to you like you're Prince Charming, don't jump into bed with him and share your charms with him right away. Wait till he pledges his whole life to you at the altar of God. But I'll tell you right now, that man might have a big wallet, but a small heart. So, you know, so I think women would give, you know, advice as well in this. But just remember, the context is an older man talking to a younger man. And so this is not meant to say that it's all women's fault, and it's just, you know, but it's just, you're a man, you just need to be alert to your own weaknesses in this. If you're not, so you can be under someone else's power before you know it. Okay. Be not intimate with a strange woman, lest you fall into her snares. Again, it sounds like it's all the woman's fault, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Again, but remember, it's an older man saying to a younger man, look, there are some women out there. I don't think it's the majority of women, but there are some women out there that definitely are type, like to entrap, who like to collect, whose ego is built up by some of these sorts of things. Obviously, there are prostitutes and others who do things like this, but there are others who may have their own motives, which may not always be love. Now, again, I'm not saying that's the majority of women. I don't even think this text implies that, but there are women like that out there. My mother, she often said to me, Charlie, I used to be a little bit more handsome, and she said, Charlie, you're a handsome young priest, and there are going to be women who will come to you, and they will wink at you and say, come hither. And she says, don't go there, you know. And I said, well, Mom, I'm not that handsome. That's not going to be a problem, you know. And I never felt I was a very handsome man, so I never picked up on it if they did wink at me. I will say there were very few occasions where maybe somebody sort of suggested, but I was too dopey or too stupid or too shy to pick up on it. So, I mean, and, you know, somebody must have been praying for me. But anyway, the point is that it never was a problem. But my mom did warn me in this way. She said, you know, she said, there are women like that out there, Charlie. I know women because I'm one of them. That's what she said. And she says that there are some women who would think nothing about getting a priest for a prize. And there are some women who this is kind of a thing on their screen. Now, I'm not saying again. I have not encountered that in 99.9% of the women I've ever met. But the fact that there may be a very small number, you still be on your guard. That's the point of this advice, not to say all women are like this, but rather just to say there are women like this out there. Be careful, be sober, be on your watch, understand something, get self-controlled sexually, do not give yourself over to the power of your own sexuality so that you fall into these traps easily. Okay? So it says here, don't be, you know, with a strange woman, lest you fall under her snares. In other words, stay with your wife. Okay? Do not be unfaithful to your wife. She is the one. Now, remember, this was in the days of arranged marriages. We talked about this, I think, last week. And we like to sniff at that and say, well, that was a horrible thing. Well, it was what it was. Rather than judge it, we probably wouldn't want to have that today. But on the other hand, with all of our romance-based marriage situations today, we're not doing so great. Marriages actually tended to be more stable when they were arranged and backed up by families. But it did tend to lead to this sort of, well, she's not really my type. This marriage was arranged. It's not merely a marriage of love. But that other one over there, she's really a charmer. And I'm going to go, you know. So that was kind of the context here. Don't do that, see, is what the text is saying. Don't run off and get a mistress. And again, mostly, poorer men wouldn't have had these options anyway, but, you know, some more wealthy men would have had options in the ancient world, and some of them did keep mistresses, and some of them did keep go to the prostitutes and things. And so this text is basically saying, look, don't do that. Okay. just nothing but trouble. With a singing girl, not be familiar. Be not familiar, lest you be caught in her wiles. Again, we realize in the ancient world they didn't have TV like we do, or music videos like we do, but they did have the theater. They did have there were different types of theater, as you might imagine. There was drama. There was entertainment, kind of the Ziegfeld Follies, the high-kicking girls. I mean, they had all that stuff in the ancient world. And people would tend to go down, and these entertainments and all were easily available in the ancient world. Because, again, they didn't have TV and other things at home, so they would often go out on days of leisure, and they would attend theaters and hear concerts and singing girls and all of these sorts of things. And they, just like today, some of them had reputations. I've often asked you to pray for this poor, I don't know the latest group of them, but this what's this girl that keeps getting into so much trouble? I just mentioned Britney Spears. But again, that type, all right? I'm not trying to say, oh, she's just garbage, she's just awful, and just hold her up for ridicule. I say pray for this girl. She's obviously confused. You know, others like her, there may be another whole crop of them now that have come along and so on. So again, please be aware that these sorts of things were there. So again, the idea of a singing girl, we might make us laugh a little, a singing girl, ha ha ha. But again, actresses, entertainment leaders, and so on, who often have a capacity, because of their popularity, to lead huge numbers of people astray. This is very common. And unfortunately, their biggest audience is teenage girls. You know, so they're going to wear bare midriff, and all the girls want to wear bare midriff. They're going to wear spaghetti strapped, and all the girls want to wear spaghetti. They're going to get a tattoo. All the girls want to get a tattoo. They're going to have a boyfriend who's 30 years old. All the little girls want to have a 30-year-old boyfriend. You know, it's just all of this pernicious stuff. And to some extent, then others fall into the trap as well. Again, this is written to a man. Generally, men aren't all that attracted to the Britney Spears types. They may look at it, oh, that's a nice-looking body, but what a dingbat, you know. But generally, the singing girls, we might laugh at the phrase, but even today, they're very influential. Was that Madonna before Britney? And Madonna let a lot of people confuse and so on. All right, so, it says here, entertain no thoughts against a virgin, lest you be enmeshed in damages for her. Now, what that means is actually financial damages. If you were found to have taken the virginity of a woman, the father or the brother could come and sue you, or even, you know, physically punish you for what you did. So, again, the idea here is, you know, financial ruin. But clearly, I mean, we would want to also add to that, I think, this idea, you know, that it just says don't even entertain thoughts against a virgin. Just don't go there. She's going to be someone else's wife. She's not your wife. And don't fantasize, because if you end up fantasizing too much, sometimes you end up going there. And just put that out of your mind altogether. Now remember, in that culture, women tended to get married around 14, maybe 15 they were married, starting to have babies by 14 or 15. So a virgin would have been a very young girl. You know, so... Anyway, stay away. In our culture, we say 15 will get you 20. That's kind of, they're basically saying the same thing. 15 will get you 20, or in this case, maybe 12 will get you 24. Something like that. All right, so, but the idea here is you're going to pay a heavy price if you deflower someone of her virginity. Because in that culture, if a woman were found to be not a virgin when she was married, she could be put away, not be considered marriageable material. She would end up being basically a person who lived on the streets, who depended on the alms that are given to the poor. All right, so women were also very strongly cautioned, and men and older brothers carefully guarded their sister and their daughter's virginity because this was an extremely serious situation if a girl lost her virginity before marriage in that culture. Okay. So there were additional issues than just simply losing the virginity. It was actually very serious penalties that would befall the girl if she did. Okay? So Now, give yourself not the harlots, lest you surrender your inheritance. Okay? Some men spend a lot of money going to whores. Pardon the expression. But that was a problem. And especially in the Greek-speaking world, as the Jews went out among the Greeks. Well, the Greeks had actually turned prostitution into a religious virtue. Now, let me explain. One of the ways you had Holy Communion with the gods in the ancient Greek religions was to go to the, quote, I'm putting this in quotes now, the sacred prostitute. And you would have relations with the sacred prostitute, and in so doing would have somehow a kind of a communion with the gods that they were priestesses of. They were considered, some of them were considered priestesses, and you had Holy Communion by having intercourse with these priestesses. Now, this is a religion every man would love. I'm actually doing something virtuous by going to the prostitute. But again, obviously, as the Jewish world encountered this, and likewise, later on, the Christian world encountered this, this had to be severely rebuked. And so, again, all of these are set here. Now, notice again, there isn't really a lot of ink spilled on this. It's not like there's 50 verses about not going to the prostitute. It just says, just don't do it. All right? Because otherwise, you're going to end up losing your money. You're going to pay a lot of money because you'll never have enough sex if you keep indulging this passion. You just never have enough. You want more and more and more and stranger and more exotic, and you're going to end up just squandering your money on this kind of stuff. Discipline yourself, man. Stay with your wife. Don't entertain thoughts against the virgin. Don't go to the prostitutes. Don't be with strange women. Don't run after singing girls. Don't do these things. Stay in your lane. Control yourself. And I'm telling you, if you don't, all kinds of trouble waiting for you. Okay? That's the bottom line. Right? Correct.
Oh, well, I'm just somebody in the way.
Yeah.
And that's what they say.
Mm.
And I said, all they want is your check.
Well, I gotta leave it anyway.
Well, they've become dull of mind, obviously, and you know their passions have dulled their mind. In fact, that leads me to tell you one thing I meant to say at the beginning of this. St. Thomas Aquinas asked the question in the Summa, are sins of intemperance the most serious of sins? Now, what are sins of intemperance? Sins about sex, sins about food, and about drink. Okay, so we're talking about drunkenness, we're talking about gluttony, and we're talking about lust. Okay, these are sins of intemperance. Now, he says, are they the most serious? And he says, no, sins of the spirit, against the spirit, are more serious. But sins of the flesh, or sins of intemperance, are the most disgraceful because of the way they have of debasing the human person. Through alcohol, we know how our behavior can become very debased. We do dumb, stupid things, unthinkable things, sometimes if we're drunk. likewise, you know, to some degree, gluttony can do that. I mean, you just become sluggish and, you know, you're just sleepy all the time and you just don't even think clearly anymore. But sex also does this. It tends to blind us. We make dopey, stupid decisions. Our mind becomes debased, confused. And sex is one of those things that the more you get, the more you want. In a little way, food and drink are the same way, aren't they? I mean, you know, it's funny how the more food you eat, you think, well, God, I've had enough, I won't be eating for days. But actually, it stretches your stomach and you want more of the stuff. And you begin to gain, your appetite tends to grow if you eat a lot. So it is with sex as well, that it tends to be something which becomes, at two levels, problematic for people. They want more and more of it if they don't learn to control themselves. And then secondly, they want stranger and more exotic forms of it. Okay, so this tends to lead them down. I think we talked about this a couple weeks ago with this internet pornography problem. You know, someone starts out looking at this stuff and it's just ordinary, you know, nudity. And then they need something a little bit more. You know, after a while that gets boring, so they want something a little more. I don't think I need to describe all the things, but you can see they go to the next stage where it's not just one person nude with several people and they're doing things together. And then stranger and stranger and sometimes younger and younger. Barely legal, all this kind of stuff is going on out there, and they end up finally on illegal sites, and before you know it, the FBI is knocking on their door. So this sort of stuff goes on, and people get ensnared because the way sexual passions are, they tend to debase the mind, they confuse us, we make stupid decisions, and we get deeper and deeper into these sorts of things. And so the idea here again is stop this at the beginning before it gets so deep and so hard and so thick that you can't get out of it. And you're really in trouble. All your money's gone. You can say you're full of disease. You know, like you're saying to these guys, and you know, you're—I don't know if you know, but how serious sexually transmitted diseases were before the age of antibiotics. I mean, people literally went mad with syphilis; they lost their minds. It became a form of madness in its later stages. Horrible, you know, gonorrhea became horrible sores, like almost like a leprosy all over the body, and just the person ultimately just was consumed by disease. So we often don't, we think, well, you know, you got the penicillin, not penicillin, whatever the, you know, people take now, but yeah, some of these sexually transmitted diseases are very serious now. They don't go away, like AIDS, for example, and very serious problems come with this behavior. And this text is saying, one man for one wife, for one man for one woman till death do you part. Stay with your wife. Be careful. Don't run after this kind of stuff. All right. Very good, plain advice. Go not about the gate. Gaze not about the lanes of the city and wander through its squares. Okay, so again, you know, there was prostitution, there were things going on, especially not so much in Jerusalem, you wouldn't find this sort of stuff, but in the Greco-Roman cities, all kinds of prostitution, all over the place. You know. Say, baby, want to go out? You know, all over the gaze, not into the lanes of the city. Ooh, let's look at the... There she is. Ooh, that one's nice. Okay, avert your eyes from a comely woman. We don't use that word comely anymore, but it means, you know, attractive, of course. Gaze not upon the beauty of another's wife. Through a woman's beauty, many perish. For lust, it burns like fire. And again, that just kind of goes with what I was just saying to you. If you don't learn to kind of control this lust, keep it contained, it just burns like fire. Now, again, you might say, well, the problem with all of these things, food and sex and drink, and when we say drink here, we don't really absolutely need it, any alcoholic beverages, all right, but let's set drink over here for a minute. But we certainly need food, and to some degree, at least as a human family, we need sexual intercourse. This is part of our experience, and, you know, this is how families are made, and this is how spouses relate in some ways. So there's a need for these things. So the how do you then find a path where you're not, you know, in this needing more and more of the stuff and more exotic or more and more food? And, you know, again, all I can say is daily self-control is, you know, all you can do. You just have to sort of set some limits and say, no, I shouldn't go beyond these limits. And if you don't do it early on, then it's really hard. You know, some people who are really overweight, I mean, talking about severely obese people, they sometimes eat 4,000 to 5,000 calories a day. And to try to put them on a 2,000 calorie diet, which is what's not going to work. You got to wean them, got to get them down there. It takes sometimes years to get them down to a normal calorie diet. I say them, I'm talking about myself, but I mean, I want you to know I've lost 20 pounds. But anyway, it's, the bottom line is that it grows. So all I can say is this is one of those problems that these are things that we can't completely do without. Now, some people can, like myself, completely do without sex. I mean, I've just made a pledge. I'm not going to do it, and I'm celibate, and I live that way, and I'm happy, and I'm fulfilled. I'm not a problem. But in an ordinary marriage, this is an expected part of the relationship. You can't just completely exclude it, nor should you. Likewise, we all need food. We could say alcoholic beverages don't need them, but you know, a glass of wine might be nice, you know, per day or something. But in the end, we set limits. And that's, we abide by them. We don't go beyond them. We have certain standards and limits, and that's the way to handle these things. So you might say, well, you know, some people just really just need more of this than others. And, well, maybe, but again, in the end, somewhere in all of these texts imply that we have the capacity as human beings to control ourselves. Okay, so that's what these texts are saying. Careful, not, you know, don't get into the habit of staring at if you're a man, don't get a habit of staring at women and their curves, and certainly don't look at pornography. In those days, they might not have had pornography like we have pornography, but they certainly had shows, and there was a lot of nudity in the theater and things like this, and people would go and look at these things, and so they had their share of it, and in the end, the text is simply saying, don't indulge this, because it starts a fire that you can't put out. Okay. Now, verse 9. With a married woman, dine not. Recline not at table to drink by her side, lest your heart be drawn to her and you go down in blood to the grave. Okay, in other words, commit adultery with her. Now, again, I know some married men who I've spoken to who have made basically an agreement that they would never be alone with another woman once they're married. Now, this may not always be possible in our culture. There are times where, for example, there must be a business luncheon or something. But I'm aware that many men would always say, they would call their wife and say, I'm going to be going out with so-and-so. We're going to be at lunch, and I'll call you when it's over. But I just want you to know where I'm going to be. See, so in other words, boundaries. Be very, very careful about boundaries. Not to be alone with someone you have no business being alone with. And likewise, as a priest, I'm very careful about boundaries as well. I don't know if you've noticed a few things about the rectory. The parlors where I meet with people, I have a window. Now, we put a sheer curtain, but you can see through if you want to. So the idea is to give some privacy, but not to go behind closed doors with people. It's just not done. All right. I never meet with, very, very seldom. There may be an occasional meeting I'll have with somebody. It's usually only a group that I'll meet with up on the second floor. I have a meeting room up there in my office. But it's usually only with groups of people. Occasionally, you know, brother priest or someone comes by. We won't sit in the parlor and talk. We'll go up in my sitting room. But in the end, I live a very transparent life. I'm not known to be alone with women, or really with anyone. I mean, in the sense that when I am, I'm out in public, I'm in my clerics. Occasionally I'll have lunch with a woman, but I'm in my clerics. It's very clear who I am, and I'm not, you know, running around and hiding. I always let my staff know where I am. I always have my cell phone. I can be reached. They know where I am and when I expect to return. So these aren't just for their sake, they're for my sake. I live a very transparent life. Now, again, I'm shy. And I never really thought of myself as particularly handsome or anything, so I never really had a big problem with sort of being out there, kind of being a ladies' man and kind of making the moves. And it's never been an issue with me. It's not so much virtue. I'm just shy. But but again, the proper boundaries are very important, and we've lost a sense of this in our culture today, especially for our young people. We no longer chaperone them. We let them, you know, engage in these dances that are inappropriate, we don't chaperone them. We don't demand that they be home at certain times. We don't even have separate dormitories for them in colleges anymore. I mean, what are we thinking? I mean, what are we thinking? That human nature has changed? I mean, clearly, we're in trouble now because we've lost any sense of boundaries and any sense of caution and modesty in our behavior. And this text is simply saying, look, don't hang out with a married woman. She's got no business doing that. She belongs to somebody else. If you're alone with her and she's alone with you and there isn't any spark between you, things will happen and the both of you will commit serious sin. And if you're caught, you could be stoned for it or you could be seriously punished for it. And likewise, even if you don't get caught, God is watching and God will see and it says you'll go down in blood to your grave. That's another way of saying you're impure, you're polluted, you're sinful, and you go to your grave that way. So again, this is simply saying be very, very cautious about all these things. So again, an older man talking to a younger man saying, look man, you've got some serious hormones running through your blood and they're going to make you do some pretty stupid stuff if you don't take authority over your life. And you be careful. A woman can have her charms and her beauties, but you be very careful because they can mislead you and you'll do stupid, dopey things. Now, it may sound at some level like the women are being blamed. Just remember this for what it is. Sometimes the best you can do to a young man is simply say, I warn you. I warn you. And it's not to say that all women are this way, that all women are, you know, engaging in bad behavior and stuff. No. But if there are enough out there that if you indulge this, they'll come around and they'll know who you are and they'll find their way to you and you'll find your way to them and you're going to be in very serious trouble. Okay. Whether it's disease, all your money going away, whether it's whatever it is, it's going to lead to nothing but trouble. So, an older man saying to a younger man, control yourself, young man. Sobriety. Don't just give way to your passion. Okay, we'll end there. And pick up with chapter 9. It is the last half of chapter 9 next week, and we'll continue on. Now, there's going to be some sections of Sirach that we won't cover, rather lengthy descriptions of certain biblical figures, which may have their interesting things, but in the end, but we'll basically, you know, just continue to move along with these chapters. Okay? So, dangerous material tonight. Men, Watch out as you leave the room. There may be retaliation, you know. Okay. I think the women have handled this all very well. Thank you. Appreciate your listening in on this conversation between men. All right. Let us pray. Lord, we do pray because in our culture today, there are many people who have run afoul of these norms, who have engaged in lots of sexual irresponsibility and really have paid a huge price. And not just them, but the children that get conceived. Some of them get aborted. The children end up growing up in dysfunctional and unstable homes. It's a problem, Lord. And we simply ask your mercy if we've in any way contributed to this, and we ask your mercy upon those who struggle with these issues, particularly the children born into these issues, who then themselves grow up and make some of the same mistakes. And so we pray for an intervention, Lord, in our world, that you will help us to come back to our senses about this sort of stuff. And just like these older men are doing for these younger men, speak to them in a very strong way about the need for sexual self-control. We pray all these blessings through Christ our Lord. Amen.
Amen.
All right. Thank you.